He had lived to fight another day. But he was alone and without weapons. Between him and Fort Brazeau lay 300 miles of open prairie. Two Indian tribes, one possibly hostile, and the other certainly so, followed the same river that he'd depended on to navigate the open space. And of course, as Glass knew painfully well, Indians were not the only hazard before him. He knew he should sleep. With the new crutch, he hoped to make 10 or even 15 miles the next day. Still, something drew him to linger in the fleeting moment of contentment, sated, rested, and warm. Glass reached into the possibles bag and pulled out the bear claw. He turned it slowly in the low light of the fire, fascinated again at the dried blood on the tip. His blood, he now realized. He began to carve at the thick base of the claw with the razor, etching a narrow groove that he carefully worked to deepen. From his bag, he also removed the hawk's feet necklace. He wrapped the string of the necklace around the groove he had carved at the base of the claw, tying it into a tight knot. Finally, he tied the ends behind his neck. He liked the idea that the claw that inflicted his wounds now hung inanimate around his neck. Lucky charm, he thought, then fell asleep. 11. September 16th, 1823. God damn it! John Fitzgerald stood staring at the river in front of him, or more accurately, at the bend in the river. Jim Bridger walked up beside him. What's it doing, turning east? Without warning, Fitzgerald backhanded the boy across the mouth. Bridger sprawled backward, landing on his backside with a stunned look on his face. What'd you do that for? You think I can't see that the river turns east? When I need you to scout, I'll ask you. Otherwise, keep your eyes open and your goddamn mouth shut. Bridger was right, of course. For more than 100 miles, the river they followed had run predominantly north, the exact bearing they sought to follow. Fitzgerald wasn't even sure of the river's name, but he knew that everything flowed eventually into the Missouri. If the river had continued its northern course, Fitzgerald believed it might intersect within a day's march of Fort Union. Fitzgerald even held out some hope that they were actually on the Yellowstone, though Bridger maintained that they were too far east. In any event, Fitzgerald had hoped to stick to the river until they hit the Missouri. In truth, he had no instinct for the geography of the vast wasteland before him. There had been little feature to the land since they struck out from the headwaters of the Upper Grand. The horizon stretched out for miles in front of them, a sea of muted grass and swelling hills, each exactly like the last. Sticking to the river made for straightforward navigation, and it assured an easy supply of water. Still, Fitzgerald had no desire to turn east, the new direction of the river for as far as their eyes could see. Time remained their enemy. The longer they wandered separate from Henry and the brigade, the greater the odds for calamity. They stood there for several minutes while Fitzgerald stared and stewed. Finally, Bridger took a deep breath and said, "We should cut northwest." Fitzgerald started to rebuke him, except that he was utterly at a loss about what to do. He pointed to the dry grassland that stretched to the horizon. "I suppose you know where to find water out there?"
"Nope, but we don't need much in this weather."
Bridger sensed Fitzgerald's indecision and felt a corresponding increase in the strength of his own opinion. Unlike Fitzgerald, he did have an instinct across open country. He always had, an internal compass that seemed to shepherd him in unmarked terrain.
"I think we're no more than 2 days from the Missouri, and maybe that close to the fort."
Fitzgerald fought back the urge to strike Bridger again. In fact, he thought about killing the boy. He would have done it back on the Grand had he not felt dependent upon the extra rifle. Two shooters weren't many, but two were better than one alone.
"Listen, boy, you and I need to reach a little understanding
before we join up with the others.
Bridger had anticipated this conversation ever since they abandoned Glass. He looked down, already ashamed of what he knew was coming.
We did our best for old Glass. Stayed with him longer than most would have. $70 isn't enough to get scalped by the Rees, Fitzgerald said, using the short name for the Aricara.
Bridger said nothing, so Fitzgerald continued.
Glass was dead from the minute that grizzly finished with him. Only thing we didn't do was bury him.
Still, Bridger looked away. Fitzgerald's anger began to rise again.
You know what, Bridger? I don't give a tinker's damn what you think about what we did, but I tell you this. You spill your guts, and I'll carve your throat from ear to ear.
12. September 17th, 1823. Captain Andrew Henry did not pause to appreciate the raw splendor of the valley spread before him. From his vantage point on a high bluff above the confluence of the Missouri and Yellowstone rivers, Henry and his seven companions commanded a vast horizon demarcated by a blunt plateau. In front of the plateau flowed gentle buttes, spilling like flaxen waves between the steep bench and the Missouri. Though the near bank had been stripped of its timber, thick cottonwoods still held the far bank, fighting against autumn for temporary possession of their greenery. Nor did Henry stop to contemplate the philosophical significance of two rivers joining. He did not imagine the high mountain meadows where the waters began their journey as pure as liquid diamond. He did not even linger to appreciate the practical import of the fort's location, neatly collecting commerce from two great highways of water. Captain Henry's thoughts concerned not what he did see, but rather what he did not. He did not see horses. He saw the scattered motion of men and the smoke of a large fire, but not a single horse.
Not even a damn mule.
He fired his rifle into the air, as much in frustration as in greeting. The men in the camp stopped their activities, searching for the source of the shot. Two guns answered in return. Henry and his seven men trudged down the valley toward Fort Union. It had been 8 weeks since Henry left Fort Union, rushing to Ashley's aid at the Aricara village. Henry left two instructions behind: trap the surrounding streams and guard the horses at all costs. Captain Henry's luck, it appeared, would never change. Pig lifted his rifle from his right shoulder, where it seemed to have augured a permanent indentation in his flesh. He started to move the heavy gun to his left shoulder, but there the strap of his possibles bag had worn its own abrasion. He finally resigned himself to simply carrying the gun in front of him, a decision that reminded him of the aching pain in his arms. Pig thought of the comfortable straw tick in back of the Cooper's shop in St. Louis, and he arrived once again at the conclusion that joining Captain Henry had been a horrible mistake. In the first 20 years of his life, Pig had never once walked more than 2 miles. In the past 6 weeks, not a single day had passed when he had walked fewer than 20 miles, and often the men covered 30 or even more. 2 days earlier, Pig had worn through the bottoms of his third pair of moccasins. Gaping holes admitted frosty dew in the morning. Rocks cut jagged scrapes. Worst of all, he stepped squarely on a prickly pear cactus. He had failed in repeated efforts to pick out the tines with his skinning knife, and now a festering toe made him wince with every step. Not to mention the fact that he had never been hungrier in his life. He longed for the simple pleasure of dunking a biscuit in gravy or sinking his teeth into a fat chicken leg. He remembered fondly the heaping tin plate of food provided thrice daily by the Cooper's wife. Now his breakfast consisted of cold jerky, and not much of that. They barely stopped for lunch, which also consisted of cold jerky. With the captain skittish about gunshots, even dinners consisted primarily of cold jerky. And on the occasions when they did have fresh game, Pig struggled to eat it, hacking at slabs of wild game or wrestling to break bones for their marrow. Food on the frontier required so damn much work. The effort it took to eat left him famished. Pig questioned his decision to go west with each rumble of his stomach, with every painful step. The riches of the frontier remained as elusive as ever. Pig had not set a beaver trap for 6 months. As they walked into the camp, horses were not the only thing absent. Where are the pelts? A few beaver plews hung on willow frames against the timber walls of the fort, along with a mishmash of buffalo, elk, and wolf, but this was hardly the bonanza to which they had hoped to return. A man named Stubby Bill stepped forward and started to extend his hand to Henry in greeting. Henry ignored the hand. "Where the hell are the horses?" Stubby Bill's hand hung there for a moment, lonely and uncomfortable. Finally, he let it drop.
"Blackfeet stole them, Captain."
"You ever heard of posting a guard?"
"We posted guards, Captain, but they came out of nowhere and stampeded the herd."
"You go after them?"
Stubby Bill shook his head slowly. "We ain't done so well against the Blackfeet."
It was a subtle reminder, but also effective. Captain Henry sighed deeply. "How many horses left?"
"Seven, well, five, and two mules. Murphy's got all of them with a trapping party on Beaver Creek."
"Doesn't look like there's been much trapping going on."
"We've been at it, Captain, but everything near the fort is trapped out. Without more horses, we can't cover any ground."
Jim Bridger lay curled beneath a threadbare blanket. There would be a heavy frost on the ground in the morning, and the boy felt the damp chill as it seeped into the deepest marrow of his bones. They slept again with no fire. In fits and starts, his discomfort surrendered to his fatigue, and he slept. In his dream, he stood near the edge of a great chasm. The sky was the purple black of late evening. Darkness prevailed, but enough light remained to illuminate objects in a faint glow. The apparition appeared at first as the vaguest of shapes, still distant. It approached him slowly, inevitably. Its contours took form as it drew closer, a twisted and limping body. Bridger wanted to flee, but the chasm behind him made escape impossible. At 10 paces, he could see the horrible face. It was unnatural, its features distorted like a mask. Scars crisscrossed the cheeks and forehead. The nose and ears were placed haphazardly with no relation to balance or symmetry. The face was framed by a tangled mane and beard, furthering the impression that the being before him was something no longer human. As the specter moved closer still, its eyes began to burn, locked onto Bridger in a hateful gaze he could not break. The specter raised its arm in a reaper's arc and drove a knife deep into Bridger's chest. The knife cleaved his sternum cleanly, shocking the boy with the piercing strength of the blow. The boy staggered backward, caught a final glimpse of the burning eyes, and fell. He stared at the knife in his chest as the chasm swallowed him. He recognized, with little surprise, the silver cap on the pommel. It was Glass's knife. In some ways, it was a relief to die, he thought. Easier than living with his guilt. Bridger felt a sharp thud in his ribs. He opened his eyes with a start to find Fitzgerald standing above him.
"Time to move, boy."
13. October 5th, 1823.
The burnt remains of the Arikara village reminded Hugh Glass of skeletons. It was eerie to walk among them. This place that teemed so recently with the vibrant life of 500 families now sat dead as a graveyard, a blackened monument on the high bluff above the Missouri. The village lay 8 miles north of the confluence with the Grand, while Fort Brazeau lay 70 miles south.
Glass had two reasons for the diversion up the Missouri. He had run out of jerky from the buffalo calf and found himself once again reliant upon roots and berries. Glass remembered the flush cornfields surrounding the Arikara villages and hoped to scavenge from them. He also knew that the village would provide the makings of a raft. With a raft, he could float lazily downstream to Fort Brazo. As he walked slowly through the village, he realized there would be no problem finding building materials. Between the huts and the palisades, there were thousands of suitable logs. Glass stopped to peer into a big lodge near the center of the village, clearly some type of communal building. He saw a flash of motion in the dark interior. He stumbled back a step, his heart racing. He stopped, peering into the lodge as his eyes adjusted to the light. No longer needing the crutch, he had sharpened the end of the cottonwood branch to make a crude spear. He held it in a ready position. A small dog, a pup, whimpered in the middle of the lodge. Relieved and excited at the prospect of fresh meat, Glass took a slow step forward. He turned the spear to bring the blunt end forward. If he could lure the dog closer, a quick whack would smash the animal's skull. No need to damage the meat. Sensing the danger, the dog bolted toward dark recesses at the back of the open room. Glass moved quickly in pursuit, stopping in shock when the dog jumped into the arms of an ancient squaw. The old woman huddled on a pallet, curled into a tight ball on a tattered blanket. She held the puppy like a baby, with her face buried against the animal. Only her white hair was visible in the shadows. She cried out and began to wail hysterically. After a few moments, the wailing took on a pattern, a frightening and foreboding chant. Her death chant? The arms and shoulders gripping the little dog were nothing more than leathery old skin hung loosely on bone. As Glass's eyes adjusted, he saw the waste and filth scattered about her. A large earthen pot contained water, but there was no sign of food. Why hasn't she gathered corn? Glass had gathered a few ears as he walked into the village. The Sioux and the deer had taken most of the crop, but certainly remnants remained. Is she lame? He reached into his parflesh and pulled out an ear of corn. He shucked it and bent down to offer it to the old woman. Glass held out the corn for a long time as the woman continued her wailing chant. After a while, the puppy sniffed at the corn, then began to lick it. Glass reached out and touched the old woman on the head, gently stroking the white hair. Finally, the woman stopped chanting and turned her face toward the light that streamed in from the door. Glass gasped. Her eyes were perfectly white, completely blind. Now Glass understood why the old woman had been left behind when the Arikara fled in the middle of the night. Glass took the old woman's hand and gently wrapped it round the corn. She mumbled something that he could not understand and pushed the corn to her mouth. Glass saw that she had no teeth, pressing the raw corn between her gums. The sweet juice seemed to awaken her hunger, and she gnawed ineffectively at the cob. She needs broth. He looked around the hut. A rusty kettle sat next to the fire pit in the center of the room. He looked at the water in the large earthen pot. It was brackish, and sediment floated on the surface. He picked up the pot and carried it outside. He dumped the water and refilled it from a small creek that flowed through the village. Glass spotted another dog by the creek, and this one he did not spare. Soon he had a fire burning in the center of the hut. Part of the dog he roasted on a spit over the fire, and part he boiled in the kettle. He threw corn into the pot with the dog meat and continued his search through the village. Fire had not affected many of the earthen huts, and Glass was pleased to find several lengths of cordage for a raft. He also found a tin cup and a ladle made from a buffalo horn. When he returned to the big lodge, he found the blind old woman as he had left her, still sucking at the cob of corn. He walked to the kettle and filled the tin cup with broth, setting it next to her on the pallet. The pup, unsettled at the smell of his brethren roasting on the fire, huddled at the woman's feet. The woman could smell the meat, too. She grasped the cup and gulped the broth the first moment the temperature would allow. Glass filled the cup again, this time adding tiny bits of meat that he cut with the razor. He filled the cup three times before the old woman stopped eating and fell asleep. He adjusted the blanket to cover her bony shoulders. Glass moved to the fire and began to eat the roasted dog. The Pawnee considered dog a delicacy, harvesting an occasional canine the way white men butchered a spring pig. Glass certainly preferred buffalo, but in his present state, dog would do just fine. He pulled corn from the pot and ate that too, saving the broth and the boiled meat for the squaw. He had eaten for about an hour when the old woman cried out. Glass moved quickly to her side. She said something over and over.
Hit to a he.
She spoke this time not in the fearful tone of her death chant, but in a quiet voice, a voice seeking urgently to communicate an important thought. The words meant nothing to Glass. Not knowing what else to do, he took the woman's hand. She squeezed it weakly and pulled it to her cheek. They sat like that for a while. Her blind eyes closed, and she drifted off to sleep. In the morning, she was dead. Glass spent the better part of the morning building a crude pyre overlooking the Missouri. When it was finished, he returned to the big hut and wrapped the old woman in her blanket. He carried her to the pyre, the dog trailing pitifully behind them in an odd cortege. Like his wounded leg, Glass's shoulder had healed nicely in the weeks since the battle with the wolves. Still, he winced as he hoisted the body up on the pyre. He felt the familiar, disconcerting twinges along his spine. His back continued to worry him. With luck, he would be at Fort Brazeau in a few days. Someone there could tend to him properly. He stood for a moment at the pyre. Old conventions calling from a distant past, he wondered for a moment what words had been spoken at his mother's funeral. What words had been spoken for Elizabeth? He pictured a mound of fresh-turned earth next to an open grave. The notion of burial had always struck him as stifling and cold. He liked the Indian way better, setting the bodies up high as if passing them to the heavens. The dog growled suddenly, and Glass whipped around. Four mounted Indians rode slowly toward him from the village at a distance of only 70 yards. From their clothing and hair, Glass recognized them immediately as Sioux. He panicked for an instant, calculating the distance to the thick trees of the bluff. He thought back to his first encounter with the Pawnee and decided to hold his ground. It had been little more than a month since the trappers and the Sioux had been allies in the siege against the Arikara. Glass remembered that the Sioux had quit the fight in disgust over Colonel Leavenworth's tactics, a sentiment shared by the men of the Rocky Mountain Fur Company. Do remnants of that alliance still stand? So he stood there, affecting as much confidence as he could muster, and watched the Indians approach. They were young. Three were barely more than teens. The fourth was slightly older, perhaps in his mid-20s. The younger braves approached warily, weapons ready, as if moving toward a strange animal. The older Sioux rode a half-length ahead of the others. He carried a London fusil, but he held the gun casually, the barrel resting across the neck of an enormous buckskin stallion. A brand etched the animal's haunch. U.S. One of Leavenworth's. In another setting, Glass might have found humor in the colonel's misfortune. The older Sioux reined his horse 5 feet in front of Glass, studying him from head to foot. Then the Sioux looked beyond him, to the pyre. He struggled to understand the relationship between this mangled, filthy white man and the dead Arikara squaw. From a distance, they had watched him struggle to place her body on the scaffolding. It made no sense. The Indian swung his leg across the big stallion and slipped easily to the ground. He He walked up to Glass, his dark eyes penetrating. Glass felt his stomach roil, though he met the gaze unflinchingly. The Indian accomplished effortlessly what Glass was compelled to pretend, an air of complete confidence. His name was Yellow Horse. He was tall, over 6 feet, with square shoulders and perfect posture that accentuated a powerful neck and chest. In his tightly braided hair, he wore 3 eagle feathers, notched to signify enemies killed in battle. 2 decorative bands ran down the doeskin tunic on his chest. Glass noticed the intricacy of the work. Hundreds of interwoven porcupine quills dyed brilliantly in vermilion and indigo. As the 2 men stood face to face, the Indian reached out, slowly extending his hand to Glass's necklace, examining the enormous bear claw as he turned it in his fingers. He let the claw drop, his eyes moving to trace the scars around Glass's skull and throat. The Indian nudged Glass's shoulder to turn him, examining the wounds beneath his tattered shirt. He said something to the other 3 as he looked at Glass's back. Glass heard the other braves dismount and approach, then talk excitedly as they pushed and probed at his back. What's happening? The source of the Indian's fascination was the deep, parallel wounds extending the length of Glass's back. The Indians had seen many wounds, but never this. The deep gashes were animated. They were crawling with maggots. One of the Indians managed to pinch a twisting white worm between his fingers. He held it for Glass to see. Glass cried out in horror, tearing at the remnants of his shirt, reaching ineffectively toward the wounds he could not touch, and then falling to his hands and knees, retching at the sickening thought of this hideous invasion. They put Glass on a horse behind one of the young braves and rode away from the Arikara village. The old woman's dog started to follow behind the horses. One of the Indians stopped, dismounted, and coaxed the dog close. With the dull side of a tomahawk, he bashed the dog's skull, grabbed the animal by the hind legs, and rode to catch the others. The Sioux camp lay just south of the Grand. The arrival of the 4 braves with a white man sparked immediate excitement, and scores of Indians trailed behind them like a parade as they rode through the teepees. Yellow Horse led the procession to a low teepee set away from the camp. Wild designs covered the teepee. Lightning bolts spewing from black clouds, buffalo arranged geometrically around a sun, vaguely human figures dancing around a fire. Yellow Horse called out a greeting, and after a few moments, an ancient, gnarled Indian emerged from a flap on the teepee. He squinted in the bright sun, although even without squinting, his eyes were barely visible beneath deep wrinkles. Black paint covered the upper half of his face, and he had tied a dead, withered raven behind his right ear. He was naked from the chest up despite the chill of the October day, and below the waist, he wore only a loincloth. The skin hanging loosely from his sunken chest was painted in alternating stripes of black and red. Yellow Horse dismounted and signaled Glass to do the same. Glass stepped down stiffly, his wounds aching anew from the unaccustomed bouncing of the ride. Yellow Horse told the medicine man about the strange white man they found in the remains of the Arikara village, how they had watched as he set loose the spirit of the old squaw. He told the medicine man that the white man had shown no fear as they approached him, though he had no weapons but a sharpened stick. He told about the bear claw necklace and the wounds on the man's throat and back. The medicine man said nothing during Yellow Horse's long explanation, though his eyes peered intently through the furrowed mask of his face. The assembled Indians huddled close to listen, a murmur rising at the description of the maggots in the wounded back. When Yellow Horse finished, the medicine man stepped up to Glass. The top of the shrunken man's head barely rose to Glass's chin, which put the old Sioux at a perfect angle to examine the bear claw. He poked at the tip with his thumb as if to verify its authenticity. His palsied hands trembled slightly as they reached to touch the pinkish scars extending from Glass's right shoulder to his throat. Finally, he turned Glass around to examine his back. He reached up to the collar of the threadbare shirt and ripped. The cloth offered little resistance. The Indians pushed close to see for themselves what Yellow Horse had described. They broke instantly into excited chatter in the strange language. Glass again felt his stomach turn at the thought of the spectacle that sparked such fervor. The medicine man said something, and the Indians fell instantly silent. He turned and disappeared behind the flap on his teepee. When he emerged a few minutes later, his arms were full of assorted gourds and beaded bags. He returned to Glass and motioned him to lie face down on the ground. Next to Glass, he spread out a beautiful white pelt. On the pelt, he laid out an array of medicines. Glass had no idea what the vessels contained.
I don't care.
Only one thing mattered.
Get them off me.
The medicine man said something to one of the young braves, who ran off, returning in a few minutes with a black pot full of water. Meanwhile, the medicine man sniffed at the largest of the gourds, adding ingredients from the assortment of bags. He broke into a low chant as he worked, the only sound to rise above the respectful silence of the villagers. The principal ingredient of the big gourd was buffalo urine, taken from the bladder of a large bull in a hunt the past summer. To the urine, he added alder root and gunpowder. The resulting astringent was as potent as turpentine. The medicine man handed Glass a short stick, 6 inches in length. It took a moment before Glass understood its purpose. He took a deep breath and placed the stick between his teeth. Glass braced himself, and the medicine man poured. The astringent ignited the most intense pain that Glass had ever felt, like molten iron in a mold of human flesh. At first, the pain was specific, as the liquid seeped into each of the 5 cuts, inch by excruciating inch. Soon, though, the pointed fire spread into a broader wave of agony, pulsating with the rapid beat of his heart. Glass sunk his teeth into the soft wood of the stick. He tried to imagine the cathartic effect of the treatment, but he could not transcend the immediacy of the pain. The astringent had the desired effect on the maggots. Dozens of the wriggling white forms struggled to the surface. After a few minutes, the medicine man used a large ladle of water to wash the worms and the burning liquid from Glass's back. Glass panted as the pain slowly receded. He had just begun to catch his breath when the medicine man poured again from the big gourd. The medicine man applied 4 doses of the astringent. When he had washed the final traces away, he packed the wounds in a steaming poultice of pine and larch. Yellow Horse helped Glass into the medicine man's teepee. A squaw brought freshly cooked venison. He ignored his stinging back long enough to gorge himself, then laid down on a buffalo robe and fell into a deep sleep. He passed in and out of sleep for almost 2 straight days. In his moments of wakefulness, he found next to him a replenished supply of food and water. The medicine man tended his back, twice changing the poultice. After the jolting pain of the astringent, the humid warmth of the poultice was like the soothing touch of a maternal hand. The first light of early morning lit the teepee in a faint glow when Glass awoke on the morning of the 3rd day, the silence broken only by the occasional rustling of horses and the cooing of mourning doves. The medicine man lay sleeping, a buffalo robe pulled over his bony chest. Next to Glass lay a pile of neatly folded buckskin clothing, breeches, beaded moccasins, and a simple doeskin tunic. He raised himself slowly and dressed. The Pawnee considered the Sioux their mortal enemies. Glass had even fought against a band of Sioux hunters in a small skirmish during his days on the Kansas plains. He had a new perception now. How could he be anything but appreciative for the Samaritan actions of Yellow Horse
and the medicine man?
The medicine man stirred, raising himself to a sitting position when he saw Glass. He said something that Glass could not understand. Yellow Horse showed up a few minutes later. He seemed pleased that Glass was up and about. The two Indians examined his back and seemed to speak approvingly at what they found. When they finished, Glass pointed to his back, raised his eyebrows questioningly to ask, "Does it look okay?" Yellow Horse pursed his lips and nodded his head. They met later that day in Yellow Horse's teepee. Through a hodgepodge of sign language and drawings in the sand, Glass attempted to communicate where he came from and where he wanted to go. Yellow Horse seemed to understand Fort Brazeau, which Glass confirmed when the Indian drew a map showing the precise placement of the fort at the confluence of the Missouri and the White River. Glass nodded his head furiously. Yellow Horse said something to the braves assembled in the teepee. Glass could not understand, and went to sleep that night wondering if he should simply strike out on his own. He awoke the next morning to the sound of horses outside the medicine man's teepee. When he emerged, he found Yellow Horse and the three young braves from the Arikara village. They were mounted, and one of the braves held the bridle of a riderless pinto. Yellow Horse said something and pointed to the pinto. The sun had just crested the horizon as they began the ride south toward Fort Brazeau. 14. October 6th, 1823. Jim Bridger's sense of direction did not fail him. He had been right when he urged Fitzgerald to cut overland and away from the eastern turn of the Little Missouri River. The western horizon swallowed the last sliver of sun when the two men fired a rifle shot to signal their approach to Fort Union. Captain Henry sent out a rider to greet them. The men of the Rocky Mountain Fur Company treated Fitzgerald's and Bridger's entry into the fort with somber respect. Fitzgerald bore Glass's rifle like the proud ensign of their fallen comrade. Jean Poutrin crossed himself as the Anstatt paraded past, and a few of the men removed their hats. Inevitable or not, the men found it unsettling to confront Glass's death. They gathered in the bunkhouse to hear Fitzgerald's account. Bridger had to marvel at his skill, at the subtlety and deftness with which he lied.
"Not much to tell," said Fitzgerald. "We all knew where it was going. I won't pretend to have been his friend, but I respect a man who fights like he fought. We buried him deep, covered him with enough rock to keep him protected. Truth is, Captain, I wanted to get moving right away, but Bridger said we ought to make a cross for the grave."
Bridger looked up, horrified at this last bit of embellishment. 20 admiring faces stared back at him, a few nodding in solemn approval.
God, not respect.
What he had craved was now his, and it was more than he could bear. Whatever the consequences, he had to purge the awful burden of their lie. His lie. He felt Fitzgerald's icy stare from the corner of his eye.
"I don't care."
He opened his mouth to speak, but before he could find the right words, Captain Henry said, "I knew you'd pull your weight, Bridger." More approving nods from the men of the brigade.
"What have I done?"
He cast his eyes to the ground. 15. October 9th, 1823. Fort Brazeau's claim to the appellation of fort was tenuous at best. Perhaps the motivation for the name had been vanity, a desire to institutionalize a family name, or perhaps the hope had been to deter attack through sheer force of nomenclature. Either way, the name exceeded its grasp. Fort Brazeau consisted of a single log cabin, a crude dock, and a hitching post. The cabin's narrow slits for shooting represented the only evidence that any consideration had been given to the martial aspects of the building, and they did more to impede light than arrows. Scattered teepees spotted the clearing around the fort, a few pitched temporarily by Indians visiting to trade, a few pitched permanently by resident Yankton Sioux drunks. Anyone traveling on the river put in for the night. They usually camped under the stars, although for two bits, the Prosperous could share space on a straw tick in the cabin. Inside, the cabin was part sundry shop and part saloon. Dimly lit, the main sensations were olfactory, day-old smoke, the greasy musk of fresh hides, open barrels of salted codfish. Barring drunken conversation, the primary sounds came from the constant buzz of flies and occasional buzz of snoring from a sleeping loft among the rafters. The fort's namesake, Kiowa Brazo, peered at the five approaching riders through thick spectacles that made his eyes appear unnaturally large. It was with considerable relief that he made out the face of Yellow Horse. Kiowa had worried about the disposition of the Sioux. William Ashley had just spent the better part of a month at Fort Brazo, planning the future of his Rocky Mountain Fur Company in the wake of the debacle at the Arikara villages. The Sioux had been allies with the whites in the battle against the Arikara. Or, more accurately, the Sioux had been allies until they had grown weary of Colonel Leavenworth's listless tactics. Halfway through Leavenworth's siege, the Sioux abruptly departed, though not before stealing horses from both Ashley and the U.S. Army. Ashley viewed the Sioux desertion as treachery. Kiowa harbored quiet sympathy for the attitude of the Sioux, though he saw no need to offend the founder of the Rocky Mountain Fur Company. After all, Ashley and his men had been Kiowa's best customers ever, purchasing virtually his entire inventory of supplies. Ultimately, though, Fort Brazo's meager economy depended on trade with the local tribes. The Sioux took on added significance since the dramatic change in relations with the Arikara. Kiowa worried that the Sioux's disdain for Leavenworth might extend to him and his trading post. The arrival of Yellow Horse and three other Sioux braves was a good sign, particularly when it became clear that they were delivering a white man who had apparently been in their care. A small crowd of resident Indians and transiting voyageurs gathered to greet the newcomers. They stared in particular at the white man with the horrible scars on his face and scalp. Brazo spoke to Yellow Horse in fluent Sioux, and Yellow Horse explained what he knew of the white man. Glass became the uncomfortable focus of dozens of gazing eyes. Those who spoke Sioux listened to Yellow Horse's description of finding Glass alone with no weapons, grievously wounded by a bear. The rest were left to wonder, though it was obvious that the white man had a story to tell. Kiowa listened to Yellow Horse's story before addressing himself to the white man.
"Who are you?"
The white man seemed to struggle with his words. Thinking he did not understand, Brazo switched to French.
"Qui êtes-vous?"
Glass swallowed and gently cleared his throat. He remembered Kiowa from the Rocky Mountain Fur Company's brief layover on its way upriver. Kiowa obviously didn't remember him. It occurred to Glass that his appearance had changed significantly, although he still had not had a good glimpse of his own face since the attack.
"You, Glass."
It pained him to speak, and his voice came out as a kind of pitiful, screeching whine.
"Ashley, man."
"You just missed Monsieur Ashley. He sent Jed Stewart west with 15 men, then headed back to St. Louis to raise another brigade."
Kiowa waited a minute, thinking that if he paused, the wounded man might offer more information. When the man showed no signs of saying anything further, a one-eyed Scotsman gave voice to the group's impatience. In a dim-witted brogue, he asked,
"What happened to you?"
Glass spoke slowly, with as much economy as possible.
"Grizzly attacked me on the Upper Grand."
He hated the pathetic whine of his voice, but he continued,
"Captain Henry left me with two men."
He paused again, placing his hand to comfort his wounded throat.
"They ran off and stole my kit."
"Sioux bring you all the way here?"
asked the Scot. Seeing the pain in Glass's face, Kiowa answered for him.
"Yellow Horse found him alone at the Arikara villages. Correct me if I'm wrong, Monsieur Glass, but I'll wager You made it down the Grand on your own?
Glass nodded. The one-eyed Scotsman started to ask another question, but Kiowa cut him off.
Mr. Glass can save his tail for later. I'd say he deserves a chance to eat and sleep.
The eyeglasses lent Kiowa's face an intelligent and avuncular air. He grabbed Glass by the shoulder and led him into the cabin. Inside, he placed Glass at a long table and said something in Sioux to his wife. She produced a heaping plate of stew from a giant cast-iron pot. Glass inhaled the food, then two more large helpings. Kiowa sat across the table from him, watching patiently through the dim light and shooing away the gawker. As he finished eating, Glass turned to Kiowa with a sudden thought.
I can't pay.
I didn't expect you'd be carrying a lot of cash. An Ashley man can draw credit at my fort.
Glass nodded his head in acknowledgement. Kiowa continued.
I can equip you and get you on the next boat to St. Louis.
Glass shook his head violently.
I'm not going to St. Louis.
Kiowa was taken aback.
Well, just where do you plan on going?
Fort Union.
Fort Union? It's October. If you make it past the Rees to the Mandan villages, it'll be December by the time you get there. And that's still 300 miles from Fort Union. You were to walk up the Missouri in the middle of winter?
Glass didn't answer. His throat hurt. Besides, he wasn't looking for permission. He took a sip of water from a large tin cup, thanked Kiowa for the food, and started to climb a rickety ladder to the sleeping loft. He stopped partway, climbed back down, then walked outside. Glass found Yellow Horse camped away from the fort on the banks of the White River. He and the other Sioux had tended their horses, done a little trading, and would leave in the morning. Yellow Horse avoided the fort as much as possible. Kiowa and his Sioux wife had always treated him honestly, but the whole establishment depressed him. He felt disdain and even shame for the filthy Indians who camped around the fort, prostituting their wives and daughters for the next drink of whiskey. There was something to fear in an evil that could make men leave their old lives behind and live in such disgrace. Beyond Fort Brazos' effect on the resident Indians, other aspects of the post left him profoundly disquieted. He marveled at the intricacy and quality of the goods produced by the whites, from their guns and axes to their fine cloth and needles. Yet he also felt a lurking trepidation about a people who could make such things, harnessing powers that he did not understand. And what about the stories of the whites' great villages in the east, villages with people as numerous as the buffalo? He doubted these stories could be true, though each year the trickle of traders increased.
Now came the fight with the Arikara and the soldiers. True, it was the Arikara that the whites sought to punish,
a tribe for which he himself held no goodwill. And true, the white soldiers had been cowards and fools. He struggled to understand his unease. Taken bit by bit, none of his forebodings seemed overwhelming, yet Yellow Horse sensed that these scattered strands came together somehow, braided in a warning that he could not yet fully perceive. Yellow Horse stood when Glass walked into the camp, a low fire illuminating their faces. Glass had thought about trying to pay the Sioux for their care, but something told him that Yellow Horse would take offense. He thought about some small gift, a pigtail of tobacco or a knife. Such trifles seemed inadequate expressions of his gratitude. Instead, he walked up to Yellow Horse, removed his bear claw necklace, and placed it around the Indian's neck. Yellow Horse stared at him for a moment. Glass stared back, nodded his head, then turned and walked back toward the cabin. When Glass climbed again to the sleeping loft, he found two voyageurs already asleep on the large straw tick. In a corner under the eaves, a ratty hide had been spread in the cramped space. Glass eased himself down and found sleep almost instantly.
A loud conversation in French woke Glass the next morning, rising to the loft from the open room below. Jolly laughter interspersed the discussion, and Glass noticed he was alone in the loft. He lay there for a while, enjoying the luxury of shelter and warmth. He rolled from his stomach to his back. The medicine man's brutal treatment had worked. If his back was not yet fully healed, the wounds at least had been purged of their vile infection. He stretched his limbs one by one as if examining the complex components of a newly purchased machine. His leg could bear the full weight of his body, although he still walked with a pronounced limp. And though his strength had not returned, his arm and shoulder could function normally. He assumed that the recoil of a rifle would cause sharp pain, but he was confident in his ability to handle a gun. A gun. He appreciated Kiowa's willingness to equip him. What he wanted, though, was his gun. His gun and a reckoning from the men who stole it. Reaching Fort Brazeau seemed markedly anticlimactic. True, it was a milestone, yet for Glass, the fort did not mark a finish line to cross with elation, but rather a starting line to cross with resolve. With new equipment and his increasingly healthy body, he now had advantages that he had lacked in the past 6 weeks. Still, his goal lay far away. As he lay on his back in the loft, he noticed a bucket of water on a table. The door opened below, and a cracked mirror on the wall caught the morning light. Glass rose from the floor and walked slowly to the mirror. He wasn't exactly shocked at the image staring back at him. He expected to look different. Still, it was strange finally to see the wounds that for weeks he could only imagine. 3 parallel claw marks cut deep lines through the heavy beard on his cheek. They reminded Glass of war paint. No wonder the Sioux had been respectful. Pinkish scar tissue ringed his scalp line, and several gashes marked the top of his head. Where hair did grow, he noticed that gray now mixed with the brown he knew before, particularly in his beard. He paid particular attention to his throat. Again, parallel swaths marked the path of the claws. Knobby scars marked the points where the sutures had been tied. Glass lifted his doe-skin blouse in an effort to look at his back, but the dark mirror showed little more than the outline of the long wounds. The mental image of the maggots still haunted him. Glass left the mirror and climbed down from the loft. A dozen men gathered in the room below, crowding the long table and spilling beyond. The conversation stopped as Glass descended the ladder from the loft. Kiowa greeted him, switching easily to English. The Frenchman's facility with language was an asset for a trader amid the frontier babble.
Good morning, Monsieur Glass. We were just talking about you.
Glass nodded his head in acknowledgement, but said nothing.
You're in luck, continued Kiowa. I may have found you a ride upriver.
Glass's interest was immediate.
Meet Antoine Larrivain.
A short man, with a long mustache, stood up formally from the table, reaching to shake Glass's hand. Glass was surprised by the power of the small man's grip.
Langevin arrived last night from upriver. Like you, Monsieur Glass, he arrived with something of a story to tell. Monsieur Langevin came all the way from the Mandan villages. He tells me that our wandering tribe, the Arikara, has established a new village on land only a mile south of the Mandans.
Langevin said something in French that Glass did not understand.
I'm getting to that, Langevin, said Kiowa,
irritated at the interruption.
I thought our friend might appreciate a bit of historical context.
Kiowa continued with his explanation.
As you can imagine, our friends the Mandans are nervous that their new neighbors are bringing trouble with them. As a condition of occupying Mandan territory, the Mandans have exacted a promise that the Arikara will cease their attacks on whites.
Kiowa removed his spectacles, wiping the lenses with his long shirt tail before returning them to the perch on his ruddy nose.
Which brings me to my own circumstances. My little fort depends on river traffic. Any trappers and traders like yourself moving up and down the Missouri.
I appreciated the lengthy visit by Monsieur Ashley and his men, but this fighting with the Arikara will drive me out of business.
I've asked Langevin to lead a deputation up the Missouri. They'll take gifts and re-establish ties with the Arikara. If they succeed, we'll send word to St. Louis that the Missouri is open for business. There's room for 6 men and supplies on Langevin's bataille. This is Toussaint Chabanon.
Kiowa pointed to another man at the table. Glass knew the name and stared with interest at the husband of Sacagawea.
Toussaint translated for Lewis and Clark. He speaks Mandan,
Arikara,
and anything else you might need on the way.
And I speak English,
said Charbonneau, which sounded like end ah speak English. Kiowa's English was almost without accent, but Charbonneau's carried the thick melody of his native tongue. Glass reached for Charbonneau's hand. Kiowa continued with the introductions.
This is Andrew MacDonald.
He pointed to the one-eyed Scot from the day before. Glass noticed that in addition to the missing eye, the Scot was missing a significant portion from the tip of his nose.
There's a good chance he's the dumbest man I ever met, said Kiowa. But he can paddle all day without stopping. We call him Professor.
Professor cocked his head to bring Kiowa within range of his good eye, which squinted in dim recognition at the mention of his name, although the irony clearly eluded him.
Finally, there is Dominique Catoire.
Kiowa pointed to a voyageur smoking a thin clay pipe. Dominique rose, shook Glass's hand, and said,
Enchanté. Dominique's brother is Louis Catoire, king of the Poutins. He's going too, if we pry him and his andouille out of the horse tent. We call Louis La Vierge.
The men around the table laughed.
Which brings me to you. They're rowing upriver, so they need to travel light. They need a hunter to provide meat for the camp. I suspect you are pretty good at finding food. Probably even better once we get you a rifle.
Glass nodded his head in response.
There's another reason our deputation can use an extra rifle, continued Kiowa.
Dominique heard rumors that an Arikara chief named Elk's Tongue has broken away from the main tribe. He's leading a small band of warriors and their families somewhere between Mandan and the Grand. We don't know where they're at, but he's vowed to avenge the attack on the Ree village.
Glass thought about the blackened remnants of the Arikara village and nodded in response.
Are you in?
Part of Glass did not want the encumbrance of fellow travelers. His plan had been to make his way up the Missouri alone, on foot. He intended to leave that day and hated the idea of waiting. Still, he recognized the opportunity. Numbers meant safety, if the men were any good. The men of Kiowa's deputation seemed seasoned, and Glass knew there were no finer boatmen than the scrappy voyageurs. He also knew that his body was still healing, and his progress would be slow if he walked. Paddling the bataille upstream would be slow, too, but riding, while the others paddled, would give him another month to mend. Glass put his hand to his throat.
I'm in.
Langevin said something to Kiowa in French. Kiowa listened, and then turned to Glass.
Langevin says he needs today to make repairs to the bataille. You'll leave tomorrow at dawn. Eat some food, and let's get you provisioned.
Kiowa kept his wares along a wall at the far end of the cabin. A plank over 2 empty barrels served as the counter. Glass focused first on a long arm. There were 5 weapons to choose from. 3 were rusted northwest muskets of ancient vintage, clearly meant for trade with the Indians. Between the 2 rifles, the choice at first seemed obvious. One was a classic Kentucky long rifle, beautifully crafted, with a burnished walnut finish. The other was a weathered Model 1803 U.S. infantry rifle, whose stock had been broken and repaired with rawhide. Glass picked up the 2 rifles and carried them outside, accompanied by Kiowa. Glass had an important decision to make, and he wanted to examine the weapons in full light. Kiowa looked on expectantly as Glass examined the long Kentucky rifle.
"That's a beautiful weapon,"
said Kiowa.
"The Germans can't cook for shit, but they know how to make a gun."
Glass agreed. He had always